3R with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Yes, it's that time again. Great to be catching up with you this afternoon here on the Country Hour. And hasn't the Prime Minister been splashing the cash around? Quite a bit of money on offer for a number of different infrastructure projects. A lot of those in the Perth area, though, as you'd be well aware, the roads, hospitals, Metronet also in there as the big ticket items I guess. But in regional areas, there's also some funding for some roads, so some big money being spent there. And one project we'll look at in particular just after 12:30 today is this Mile Up Wellington Dam project, getting $140 million. So that's big news in the southwest of the state. So looking at that project in quite a bit of detail after 12:30. But if you could get your hands on some of that money, where might you spend it? Has something important missed out that you think that money could have been spent on? Let me know this afternoon, 0448 922 604 is the text. Did I get that right? I think I did. 0448 922 604. I think I got it right the first time. Let me know what you would like some of that money spent on. I would also, just before the news at one today, catching up on the wool market results too, because that's all back to normal today. A couple of disruptions to the livestock markets this week due to the Anzac Day holiday right in the middle of the week, but the wool market pressed on, so we'll get a wrap of that just before the news at 1 o'clock. And the Australian Livestock Exporters Council is saying that customers in the Middle East are really worried about the threat of a mid-year pause in the trade and are now questioning future investments into things like the new vessels, new ships, and infrastructure projects worth hundreds of millions of dollars. The latest industry crisis was sparked when the 60 Minutes TV program showed footage of dead sheep on several voyages to the Middle East. And in one shipment that's highlighted in particular, this was last year, 2,400 sheep died on board the livestock carrier, the Awassi Express, which has been docked at Fremantle for around about 3 weeks now, waiting for that green light to start another voyage. Tom Dawkins is the secretary of the Australian Livestock Exporters Council, and he's in Broome today. He's been spending some time in WA, catching up with export companies here in Perth and taking the flight to Broome to be part of a pastoralist conference, and you'll hear more about that conference shortly. First up, though, Tom, what disruptions is the current crisis in the live animal export trade having on the shipping schedules of the export companies?
There's obviously been some disruption to our supply chains and some delays in getting these sheep vessels sailing to the Gulf. That has disrupted the natural flow of the supply chain to an extent, obviously, with a fortnight delay. So there would be a risk of putting essentially three vessels carrying combined more than 200,000 sheep into the Gulf in a short space of time. So that means that the importer, in consultation with the exporters, decided that it would use its two vessels, the Al-Masila and the Al-Shawaik, and release its charter of the Awassi Express, which is loading fodder in Fremantle and heading to Broome en route to Southeast Asia with cattle, with a different exporter.
What are the costs involved with the delays to the shipping schedule? As you said, we've got, at the moment, two livestock vessels in at Fremantle, another one on its way almost at Fremantle, and it's sort of created that bottleneck situation, which you are now trying to avoid. But what are the costs associated with those sort of delays in the shipping schedule?
The cost for demurrage on a vessel when we have these sorts of delays starts at about $50,000 a day. So you put that out over a fortnight or so, and it is a considerable cost. These vessels are workplaces and homes to crew and officers, and that obviously entails wages and the costs of running the ship's living infrastructure, I would say, to ensure meals are prepared and amenities are available. So there is that cost. There's the cost of holding sheep in pre-export quarantine feedlots near Perth. But I guess, you know, not more significantly, but just as significantly, I guess, given the seasonal conditions in Western Australia, there's the delay in delivering sheep now to the pre-export quarantine. And that's forcing producers with sheep due to be live exported to be hand feeding their animals, and that's a significant unwanted cost, I guess.
So those 60,000 sheep originally earmarked to be loaded on the Awassi, they've been in quarantine all this time, sort of the 3 weeks while business was being sorted out. Is the plan to load them on the Massilla now, which is also docked in Fremantle? And how appropriate would that be, considering that ship had many sheep die on it during a voyage in 2016?
That's obviously a consideration. With regard to the Massilla, it has, in the 18 months or more that have passed since that incident, it's passed all its appropriate tests and has had, you know, a number of successful voyages to the Gulf. So we are confident, based on that record of service, that, you know, it is ready to sail.
How are the markets in the Middle East responding to this current scenario? What are those markets telling the exporters?
There's concern about the reliability of supply, which is pertinent given the spikes in demand we see around various festival periods throughout the year, Ramadan and later Eid al-Adha. They want a guaranteed supply without the risk, I guess, of going a period without any supply and then forcing upon the market the potential of a short-term oversupply, which is a very risky thing, and it's something that none of us have an appetite to do.
What response would there be from the marketplace if there was a pause in the trade in the middle of the year? Would those markets, are they indicating they'd stay faithful to Australia or move on elsewhere for sheep?
There's a lot of concern from the Gulf about that. Our customers are questioning the threat, I guess, of a suspension. They've all got significant infrastructure and investments in this supply chain. They've been loyal to Australia for Kuwait. You know, it's going back to 1960 or thereabouts. So they want the confidence to complete projects like the new slaughterhouse that's being built in Kuwait City, which will rationalise the supply chain and, you know, reinforce the control and traceability we've got in the supply chain. And an investment in renewing the fleet in new vessels, and that's hundreds of millions of dollars to contemplate, and it's difficult to do that if the trade's put in doubt.
On ABC Radio WA, this is The Country Hour. Belinda Varaschetti with you, and talking to you this afternoon, Tom Dawkins. He's from the Australian Livestock Exporters Council, and he's in Broome today to catch up with pastoralists in northern Western Australia. Tom, State Agriculture Minister Alana McTiernan said there can only be one of two outcomes from the McCarthy review into the trade, which was announced by the Federal Minister David Littleproud. She says that will either be a pause in the trade in the northern summer or a significant reduction in the number of animals being transported on those voyages. She sounded very confident about that outcome ahead of the report's release. What do you make of that prediction?
Dr. McCarthy's a very experienced vet. He'll make his decisions based on hard evidence and data. We respect the minister's interest in our industry, but we certainly won't be entering into any commentary to preempt the doctor's findings.
The minister, Alana McTiernan, also says that it's time now to go to the Middle East and start talking about the changes that are coming. The talk has already started by the sounds of things, but do you support that move, going to the Middle East and saying to these markets, look, it's going to be this or it's going to be that? It's going to be a pause or it's going to be a significant reduction in numbers?
Our industry is strongly linked with the Gulf in particular, and more broadly the Middle East. So any suggestion that we need to commence a conversation with our customers in the Gulf is a bit wide of the mark, because, you know, we're speaking to our customers in the UAE and Kuwait and Qatar on a daily basis. It's part of our business.
The other live export carrier, the Masora, left Fremantle, I think it was last week, and there is quite a few differences of opinion about what happened during the approval process for that sheep to sail. The State Minister, McTiernan, saying that she has text message evidence to show the department wanted approval to go onto the vessel, and on several occasions that was denied by the company, and that's why a warrant was sought. The Pastoralists and Graziers Association has already questioned who those text messages were sent to, because the head of the PGA, Tony Seabrook, said he's spoken to the company and has been told those messages were never received. Can you shed any light on that situation? Because while you've been in WA this week, you've been catching up with the people at these export companies. What have they told you?
I was on board when the inspectors visited us, and they were, you know, polite in carrying out what they were sent there to do. And when they came up the gangplank, myself and exporter representatives welcomed them. I think that there was an initial message sent via SMS to one of the company's representatives who was actually on the other side of the country in Townsville. Our expectation probably going forward, and we've indicated this, that if there is a request to board, maybe it's done in a bit more proper channels than sending a text message. I guess we've all got expectations, especially dealing with the government, that there'll be sort of proper channels used in this correspondence, especially if there's sensitivities around it. That's why there was confusion about there being an initial invitation, but we would expect emails or more formal correspondence for a request like this, especially when it's taking place for the first time.
The Australian Livestock Exporters Council released a list of initiatives last week, taking the federal minister's suggestion to get ahead of the McCarthy review and develop a strategy for the trade to continue that the exporters, the farmers, and the broader community would support too. And it included support for an independent observer, establish an inspector general for welfare of exported animals and reduction of stocking density. That seems to fall short of what the state agriculture minister will find acceptable. Why didn't you opt for something more significant, a more significant step, taking the lead on this rather than being waiting to be told what's going to be happening to the industry?
I guess we've got to put this conversation in context, and with regard to August 2017, the department and the exporter actually were very proactive in getting some of these measures in place within the context of our regulatory system.
But it seems to just always be chipping around the edges, because this time around, it seems the momentum is there for quite a significant change, not just a little tweak here and there.
And hence I speak of context. So that's happening well before there's any footage released by Animals Australia. There's an ASIL review, the Australian Standards for the Export of Livestock, which we called on and have been pushing for a number of years. The federal government's now commenced that, and that goes to the stocking standards and the conditions in which livestock are shipped, and the accountability and transparency in that framework. I think Minister McTernan's supportive of there being an independent animal welfare specialist who focuses on livestock export, and we welcome that. It hasn't been necessarily something that we've contemplated in the past, but the last fortnight or so has been a reminder, a pretty confronting reminder to the exporters about the need for the regulations that govern our trade to be aligned with community expectations and to remain connected with those community expectations at all times.
The latest saga is about sheep shipments to the Middle East during the northern summer. You're in Broome today talking to pastoralists in the cattle industry. Does this sheep export situation have certain flow-on effects for cattle producers?
When we have politicians, especially those a long way away from Broome, whether they're to the south or on the east coast, I think it really rattles producers in the north, who are still traumatised by the suspension of 2011. It might be moving to the back of their minds, but they still wear the wounds and the scars of that experience.
Tom, good to talk to you. Thanks for your time today on The Country Hour.
Thank you, Belinda.
Have your say on The Country Hour. SMS the program on 0448 922 604.
It'd be great to get your input this afternoon here on The Country Hour on ABC WA. Tom Dawkins from the Australian Livestock Exporters Council. He's in Broome today and heading off to that Pastoralists and Graziers Association conference, which is on today. And interesting, just his comments at the end talking about how this is a sheep industry issue we're talking about, the shipment of live sheep to the Middle East, which is the current crisis. But the cattle producers in the north of the state still traumatised by that shutdown of the trade in 2011, and still those wounds and scars from that time too, according to Tom Dawkins, ABC WA 20 past 12. Well, Tom Dawkins is there for this particular conference, and so is rural reporter Courtney Fowler in Broome today, and she's sitting in on this PGA Northern Conference, which is underway right now. Obviously, there's going to be talk about the live export trade, its future. Will there be this pause in the middle of the year? Will there be a significant reduction in the numbers of sheep that is going to these Gulf countries? A lot of talk about that. But there are other things going on today, talking about other aspects of the pastoral industry, roads to conservation to the global cattle supply chain. This morning, just before coming on air, caught up with a couple of pastoralists and just asking them about how they felt ahead of the conference today and considering what's going on with the sheep industry, the live sheep trade at the moment, and trying to get a sense of what that feeling is about the future of their trade, their cattle trade. And I really can't use the language that I heard on the phone today in these conversations, but I guess you get the picture of what I'm talking about. They're worried about the future, basically. Now, Courtney, you're in the room. In fact, I think you've just stepped out of the conference where all the pastoralists are in Broome today. Is that a common conversation or sentiment that's coming over as you've sort of been having these conversations during morning tea today?
Yeah, g'day, Belle. Well, there's around 30 to 40 people here, pastoralists from the Kimberley mainly, some from the Pilbara as well. A few less than normal because muster's ramping up, of course. But yeah, conversations about live trade have been really prominent in conversations today between cattle producers in the room. I think opinions really mixed. Some people are very worried and concerned about the future of live exports in general, wondering whether restrictions or bans on the sheep trade may result in the cattle industry, you know, being next in the firing line. Others aren't at panic stations yet, to sort of quote some words used around the room, but, you know, keeping a real close eye on how this unfolds. But I think there's one thing for sure, pastoralists hearing this live trade discussion can't help but reflect on the trade closure back in 2011 and the damage it did to the northern pastoral industry. I mean, they'd be dreading another trade closure. Talking to one producer here, you know, live export makes up 60 to 70% of their income. And, you know, for some producers, Addo in the East Kimberley, it's in the realms of 70 to 80% of their cattle goes off on live export. So, you know, there's definitely sentiment in the room to be concerned, and also that sheep and cattle industries need to stick together on this one. You know, one producer said the sheep industry backed us in 2011 when the cattle trade was closed, and us cattle producers need to now reciprocate that support.
Well, the Pastoralists and Graziers Association president is Tony Seabrook, and he's already spoken at the meeting today, at the conference today, and he did spend some time just updating the pastoralists on what's unfolding within the sheep industry. But he also had a warning for cattle producers, and here's just a little of what he had to say.
We are fighting these people with every bit of capacity the association has. Now, you may see this as a sheep issue. It certainly is for people where I live, and a number of them said if this happens and the ban is put in place, we're out. But they will not be content. I understand some film footage around of some events that have happened north of here, Vietnam, that may well be the next piece of information that we see out and about. The first and worst thing they can do would be to create a hiatus over those 9 to 10 weeks of the really hot period up there, because we will then become exactly what you became, unreliable suppliers.
Courtney, how did the crowd, how did the pastoralists respond to Tony Seabrook's address this morning?
One thing that did see people sort of sit up in their seats a bit was when Tony Seabrook mentioned rumours that there may be more negative footage afoot on the live trade. He said that could be coming. That's definitely got producers concerned. You know, they don't know what to prepare for, what the footage exactly is, whether it's on board a live export vessel or a foreign abattoir, as was the case in 2011. But it's definitely got pastoralists feeling uneasy. Some pastoralists in the room, you know, they've said, you know, they respect animal activists, have a job to do, but they feel like they're part of a staged attack on the industry with these dribs and drabs of footage coming out and what they say seems like an orchestrated media campaign from animal activist groups like Animals Australia. As I said earlier, live export. It's the bread and butter of the northern beef industry. One producer saying, 60 to 70% of their income is from live trade. So hearing Tony Seabrook's thoughts on the potential future is concerning to them. In the morning tea break just now, pastoralists were saying, though, that they need to be more proactive with their public image as well and show how they look after their stock. That's been a huge focus of the morning, building those relationships up through social media and bridging that country-city divide. They want to show that they take animal welfare very seriously on the farm and, expect exporters to do so as well. They want consumers to know that.
Now, what else is on the agenda for the rest of the conference, Courtney?
There's been a bit of talk about other key issues facing the WA pastoral industry. Land tenure, of course, has been up there with native title and some of the issues facing pastoralists down the Gascoyne with wild dogs. They've all been quite topical. After lunch, we'll be talking drones and pastoral conservation. I'll also be fortunate enough to hear from AgriFutures Rural Woman of the Year, Darylin Gordon, who we've heard from before on the Country Hour, a bit about the work she's doing down at Lambie Station with the local Indigenous communities. And after that, I think it's just about time we knock off for a beer and barbecue, Bill.
Oh, that sounds... I knew that was going to be on the agenda, Courtney. Hey, thank you for that. Good to talk to you. I'll let you get back to that conference.
Thanks, Bill.
ABC Rural reporter Courtney Fowler. She's in Broome today, usually in Kununurra, but she's made the trip over to Broome just to be part of the Pastoralists and Graziers Association's Northern Conference. 26 past 12.
This is the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
News headlines, a look at the weather around Western Australia, not too far away, just after 12:30 today. Just before we get there, a 20,000 hectare decline in pine plantations in the south of the state has put the future of the softwood forestry industry in jeopardy. Now, that's according to Southwest Agroforestry Network President Duncan Beggs. And he's warning that WA processors may be forced to close down if the drop in the number of trees planted continues, as it is at the moment. Mr. Beggs says private WA growers are getting about up to 40% less for their pine when you compare what growers on the eastern states are getting for theirs. So 40% less than what the farmers can take away in the eastern states. And he says an independent and transparent review of the industry is needed now before it's too late.
You'll get to the point where the supply of pine to the processors is below the economic quantity for them, and they will have to reappraise their future in the industry.
So it could be the death knock for the West Australian industry?
Under the current arrangements, if we lost those processing facilities, yes, it means the end of the local industry.
What's causing this shortfall of new kind of plantation land?
We're not sure why. Overall, private growers have exited the growing of pine because of the lack of viable return. But why the stock of land or stock of pine owned by the government is declining, we're unable to say.
So for private owners anyway, it seems like the issue is low pricing. What's driving this suppressed price in the industry in WA?
At the moment, the bulk of the supply of pine is coming from Forest Products Commission to the processors. There is a state agreement that was entered into around about 1992. The price under that agreement seems to be too low for private growing of pine.
And is that where all this new plantings need to happen, on privately owned land?
Nobody's talking about cutting down state forest to plant pine. That is just not being talked about. The only other option is for the 20,000 hectares that is needed to be grown on freehold land. That can either be purchased by government or it can be planted by private growers.
Is the price being offered to WA growers comparable to elsewhere in the country?
We believe that the price that is available to private growers of pine here in Western Australia could be upwards of 30 or 40% below the price that growers are getting for pine on the eastern coast. That's what we're hearing from over east.
So what's causing that difference in pricing?
As I said before, the bulk of the market is controlled by Forest Products Commission at the moment, supplying to the processors under the state agreement. We're not certain that we know what that price is. What we are told is that the price that growers get when they try to sell pine in the local market is not viable.
And roughly how much does the state-controlled forestry commission run or control in the WA industry?
We don't have exact figures, but it's by far the majority. Because of the small quantity of pine produced by private growers, it stands to reason that the rest of the market is supplied by Forest Products Commission to the processors. And certainly, if then there are a few independent millers, they're small, they take supply from Forest Products Commission as well. They get some from private growers, but the bulk of it is coming from Forest Products Commission.
I mean, you say you believe the price in WA being offered to growers is potentially 30 to 40% less than our eastern states counterparts, but is the retail price any different?
Anecdotally, from checking prices with a few retailers on the East Coast and here locally, the price for a tradie going into a local retailer is about the same.
How do you feel about this current state of the industry in the West?
We are concerned. That's why at a meeting last Sunday, we expressed concern about the future of the industry and asked for a review of the industry to be undertaken by the Economic Regulatory Authority. It's a monopoly, or it's tantamount to a monopoly situation at the moment, and we think that warrants an investigation by the ERA so we can get some facts on the table. And I'm sure that government and private growers, industry would all benefit from that being put out on the table, so we all know and we're all dealing with the same information.
Duncan Beggs, he's from the Southwest Agroforestry Network, talking there with the ABC's John Daly. We did approach the Forest Products Commission for comment, and it released a statement from business manager Andrew Lyon. It says, since the collapse of managed investment schemes, there's been little private investment in plantations. The Forest Products Commission is investing $21 million over 5 years just to try and increase the state's softwood plantation estate. And it says forestry is a long-term business and the state government has taken a strategic view of the industry. And this investment, the $21 million, represents a significant funding injection in the forest industry. ABC WA, it is 28 to 1. And Vicky Saleur in the studio. What's happening in the news headlines, Vicky?
Thanks, Belinda. In the news, federal agricultural officials will allow the company at the centre of the live export scandal to again send sheep to the Middle East. The ABC understands Emmanuel Exports will send 68,000 sheep to the Middle East this weekend on a different ship that it had planned to use, will have less sheep packed into pens on board, and allow an independent observer to travel on board during the voyage. The Premier Mark McGowan has indicated his federal Labor colleagues need to boost what they're offering WA in the wake of a major funding commitment from the Turnbull government of $3.2 billion in infrastructure funding, including $500 million for the Ellenbrook train line. Federal Labor's promised to create a $1.6 billion WA infrastructure fund, which is designed to make up for the state's low GST share. And historic talks between the North and South Korean leaders are continuing in private today, with the two men vowing to make real progress during the historic inter-Korean summit. I'll have more news at 1.
Vicky, thank you so much for the update. ABC WA 26 to 1. The wool market details, Tony Alossi along just before the news at 1 o'clock today, and also talking about some farming advice from many years ago. Apparently, they were on the money all those years ago. So we'll look at that shortly here on the Country Hour, and also talking about that money that the Prime Minister has been splashing around today, looking at one project that got the nod in that bag of money today, and it could mean big changes for horticulture in this state. So looking at the Wellington Dam in the southwest of the state shortly. And I was asking you about some of the other things you might have liked that money to be spent on. This text through saying Great Eastern Highway is badly in need of some serious money, not just patch-up jobs. The section between Walgoolan and Southern Cross especially. Do you have any other ideas? If you could have had your say, and put some of that money somewhere in particular in rural and regional WA, where would that have been? 0448 922 604 is the text. Off to the Weather Bureau now, and Stephen McInerney with you this afternoon. Stephen, let's have a look at northern and eastern parts.
Yeah, good afternoon, Belinda. So as you say, I mean, generally the weather for the next few days is going to be confined to those northern and eastern parts. So currently we still have some showers and thunderstorms sort of in through central parts of the goldfields, and that's sort of stretching down towards the eastern parts of the southwest land division, so sort of east of Esperance as we speak. That's going to continue contracting eastwards as we go overnight and into Saturday morning, with those thunderstorms mainly confined towards the Eucla region by tomorrow morning itself. But then in the afternoon, they should stretch back up through the goldfields interior up towards the central parts of the Pilbara. So generally tomorrow, thunderstorms through those central parts. And then as we go towards Sunday, a little bit of contraction towards the northeast, so they'll be more confined through the interior district, western parts of the Kimberley and also eastern parts of the Pilbara. Then on Monday and Tuesday, generally the weather's going to slowly ease, so those showers and thunderstorms become more isolated through the interior, the western Kimberley and also, I suppose, the inland coastal areas for the Pilbara itself during Monday. Then Tuesday, it's going to be pretty much confined just the northern parts of the Kimberley, so yeah, the next couple of days, we'll see a little bit of weather around, but as we go towards the start of the next week, showers and thunderstorms will begin to contract northwards.
All right, let's move south now. The Southwest Land Division, what can you see?
Yeah, so the Southwest Land Division, unfortunately, not much in the way of weather, because we are going to be experiencing a pretty reasonable high-pressure system over the next few days. So we have seen a little bit of shower activity along the south coast and adjacent regions today. As we go towards tomorrow morning, that will slowly contract eastwards towards the southeast coastal district and along, I guess, the coastal areas east of Albany. By Sunday, though, we are going to see pretty much fine conditions throughout the southwest land division, with temperatures generally in the, I suppose, the mid-20s for the southern regions, getting in towards, I guess, the mid-30s, potentially upwards around the Geraldton and then inland parts from there. On the weekend, though, we will see another weak cold front moving in later in the day, but it will only affect the far southwestern parts of that southwestern southwest land division. So probably see some showers in coastal areas south of Mandurah and then along the area towards Israelite Bay. And then Tuesday, similar again, with showers generally through the coastal parts with onshore flow, but again, the majority of the southwest land division going to remain fine.
And any warnings today?
No warnings today. So, yeah, pretty much benign conditions throughout the state.
Very good. Thank you for the wrap. Stephen McInerney with the details this afternoon. ABC WA 22 to 1. And no rainfall of any significance to report to you in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. Earlier in the hour, catching up with Tom Dawkins, and he's from the Australian Livestock Exporters Council. He's in Western Australia this week. He's been talking to the companies, the live animal exporters in Perth, and he's made his way to Broome to be part of the Pastoralists and Graziers Association's Northern Conference. And talking to you this afternoon about how the customers, the markets in the Middle East, are really worried about this threat of a mid-year pause in the sheep trade to that region, and are now questioning some of the future investments that they're talking about in that part of the world, like looking at investing in new vessels and infrastructure projects, slaughterhouse, for example, and these projects worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Obviously, that concern coming from the possibility, there's nothing definite at this stage, but certainly the talk about that suspension of the trade in the middle of the year or a significant reduction in the numbers of sheep going to the region at that time of the year. On text, this through from David. As a sheep farmer, I'm extremely concerned if the live export trade was to stop in the June to August period. When the state has its next drought, where does Alana McTiernan propose we offload our stock to? In this situation, there needs to be a rapid destocking both for animal welfare and to stop wind erosion to our farms. There is no capacity with slaughterhouses to cater for this situation, and we highly rely on live export to destock. Make the exporters accountable, not the farmers. Thank you for that, David. The text is 0448 922 604, and maybe I can sneak in a few more of your comments before the news at 1 o'clock today. ABC WA 19 to 1.
You're with Belinda Varischetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio WA.
As you would have heard in the news today, the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, has announced $3.2 billion of new infrastructure funding earmarked for Western Australia. And as John Daly reports, it could mean some big changes for horticulture here in WA.
Undoubtedly, the metro region was the biggest winner in Malcolm Turnbull's infrastructure funding commitment. Money has been allocated to a number of Perth roads, hospitals, and the big one, the Metronet. But in regional areas, there's also been some funding for a couple of big ticket items. The Great Northern Highway Bindu Bypass has been funded to the tune of $220 million. The federal government says it will also provide up to $140 million for the Mile Up Wellington Dam project. And that's big news if you're in the southwest. The Wellington Dam is the state's second biggest surface water reservoir, and it holds a whopping 185 gigalitres of water. But this water is currently useless to farmers in the Collie and Mile Up irrigation area because it's too salty. However, Harvey Water General Manager Brad Hammersley says the $140 million announced by the federal government will allow a desalination project to go ahead, and that's going to make more water available for southwest horticulturalists.
Dropping the salinity of that water down to a far lower number allows us potentially to reintroduce some of those high-value horticulture crops, which is a trigger for investment in agriculture in that Collie River Irrigation District. And obviously additional water out to Mile Up means the potential for growth.
How many jobs and how much economic growth could this bring to the region?
So we've had an independent cost-benefit analysis done as part of the project application, and it's demonstrated that there are 830 newly created jobs spread between the construction phase and the ongoing operation phase of the plant, as well as an uplift in gross state product of $570 million each year. The project has a concession life of 20 years, and logically we expect it to continue beyond that. So it's a significant amount of growth for the state.
When might we see this project come online?
We're ready to extract winter flows this year, so effectively in the next 6 to 8 weeks, pending a final approval, we can start extracting some fairly minor flows out of the Collie River East Branch into a disused mine pit, which effectively kickstarts the reduction of salinity inside a Wellington Dam. It's not going to have as great an effect as the permanent infrastructure, but it's a start, John.
When might we see some permanent infrastructure?
Sure, permanent infrastructure. So being a PPP or public-private partnership type transaction, you have to achieve what they call financial close. That effectively sets out what they call condition precedent. So your approvals, your other things you need to meet in order to extract the federal fund and state funding. So that's a sort of a 6-month process. Immediately after that, we'd be into some early works, I would have thought. So your civil works for your desalination plant, etc., should come online shortly thereafter.
Right, so we could see some substantial desal construction in the next, you know, six to 12 months.
Yeah, certainly around 12 months, you'd see probably the start of a desalination plant. Before that, some early works in order to obviously facilitate the project. But in terms of, you know, economic stimulus, it will generate something for the southwest inside of 12 months, certainly. It probably provides a bit of confidence for our irrigator members to invest in agriculture. A lot of the guys there, you know, have struggled, I guess, with, you know, the fact that they can only grow so much and their, I guess, crops have been sort of pulled back to pasture for both dairy and beef. It will allow a bit of investment. Out of Mile Up, certainly, you know, that land is being opened up now as the pines are being relocated above Wellington Dam. And, you know, you'll see pockets of new land come available pretty quickly. So it's not a day one change, but certainly you'll see some confidence back in the agricultural sector to invest.
Harvey Water General Manager Brad Hammersley. And while it sounds like an important step for agriculture in the region, growers like Joe Castro in Mile Up aren't totally convinced.
Yeah, it's good. But it won't happen for a fair while. I can't see it happening because Tom will detail the water up there and try and get Welly Dam to a better level in salinity or chloride levels. It's going to take quite a few years. And the time they get a, you know, get the water down there, you're talking a fair few years. And then the cost of the water is going to be expensive for us as well, I think, what I can make out reading between the lines.
Yeah, are you self-supplying your water at the moment?
Yes, yeah, yeah. We'd probably pump about 2 gig of water a year. We lease some farms and we got our own. Yeah, so I think it's going to cost about $200 a meg, give or take a bit, roughly, in the future. And it's fairly cutthroat, the horticulture game anyway, so...
Could the supply from the Wellington Dam give you options to expand, do you think?
Well, they will give you more water, yes. Because they're currently allowed 4 megs a hectare allocation on all your properties. Yeah. So you could probably use more. Yeah, that's what they're aiming at anyway.
ABC's John Daly with that report, looking at some of the parts of that, the infrastructure projects that have been the winners out of that $3.2 billion of infrastructure funding, which has been earmarked for WA by the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, today. And asking you about where you would like some of that money spent. Look, I don't think you've got any options at this stage. I think it's all sorted. But just if you could, if there's a project that you think might have been worthy of some of that money. The text is 0448 922 604. This through from Michael. Spend some money on the Mora College. What's your suggestion? 0448 922 604. And also talking about the live trade too this afternoon. I will get to some of those comments coming through on the text very shortly. ABC WA 14 to 1. And just talking about that news of the Wellington Dam funding, you may be thinking, what are the implications for some of the other projects in that area? In particular, what's going to happen to the proposed Southern Forest Irrigation Scheme? Now, the Southern Forest proposal is all about supplying water to growers in the Manjimup Pemberton area in the southwest of the state. But the burning question is where the federal funding for the Wellington project is coming from. If it's from the National Water Initiative, well, that could mean the end for the Southern Forest Plan. But Terry Redman, who's the member for Warren Blackwood, which includes this Southern Forest region, says the $140 million could be coming from elsewhere. He spoke to Tyne Logan on ABC Southwest.
It is my understanding. I had a quick chat with Rick Wilson this morning. I've got a current call into the Deputy Prime Minister to hopefully find out very soon that the project announcement for Mile Up Wellington this morning came out of a sort of a compensation fund for GST for Western Australia. If that's the case, then we know there are still resources in the National Water Initiative hopefully available for other projects such as the Southern Forest Irrigation Project. So we do try and maintain a positive thought around the current budget coming up and that it might have an outcome for that project.
So if this has come out of a different funding pool, then perhaps there's even more of a chance of the Southern Forest Irrigation Scheme getting up. Is that right?
Yeah, well, to me, that's a good thing. If the two projects were competing out of what I understand to be only about $140 million in the total fund
which
for the nation,
which is what
what's
asked
left
for in Harvey.
If they're competing for that, then the likelihood of getting something for this project is probably considerably lower. I think there is an angle to this argument that says it's probably good news. But again, we wait and see, and I'd certainly like to see it landed. A lot of people have put a lot of effort into this. There's the skin in the game from the local producers here in the southwest region, the Southern Forest region, and a project that will add a lot of jobs and add a lot of capacity to our agricultural sector.
Warren Blackwood member Terry Redman talking about the future of the Southern Forest Irrigation Scheme. 12 to 1, some of your thoughts coming through this afternoon, and thank you for that on the text 0448 922 604. Talking earlier in the hour about the live export industry and the current review that's underway, the McCarthy review into the trade, which I think is due in just a couple of weeks' time. On the text from Andy, it appears that the impact of sheep stranded in WA feedlots is impacting on domestic producer feed pellet availability. Sheep feed is tight across Western Australia and a quick defined resolution to the current impasse is needed. Thank you for that, Andy. Thank you for highlighting that this afternoon. And also this afternoon, talking moments ago, just before 12:30, about a 20,000 hectare decline in pine plantations in the south of the state, which is putting the future of the softwood forestry industry in jeopardy. This through from Colin. The Forest Products Commission has had 200 years to grow hard and softwood resource, too busy wasting taxes on free native forest, losing millions of dollars per annum. Disgraceful is Colin's thought this afternoon. 10 to 1, news for you at 1 o'clock, and just before the news, catching up with Tony Alossi today, and he'll go through the details of this week's wool market. And a bit of good news too, I think, just looking ahead slightly, the Eastern Market Indicator up 21 cents. And here in the West, the Western Market Indicator up 15 cents this week. So wool still going strong by the looks of things. Tony will go through the details for you shortly. Now, would you trust farming advice from 106 BC? Plant biologists from the University of Western Australia have vindicated Roman farmers who realised their wheat crops were more susceptible to flood damage when temperatures warm up. The advice to drain waterlogged wheat fields was recorded in De Agricultura, believed to be written by Cato the Elder, a farming manual believed to be the oldest surviving known work written in Latin. Professor Harvey Miller from the ARC Centre of Excellence in Plant Energy Biology at UWA says they were bang on the money.
Well, there was obviously a lot of information in farmers to know. There's a lot of basic information, basic knowledge about how to grow things more effectively, and a lot of knowledge passed on from father to son about how to do farming, just as there is today. Obviously, there's things about the science they didn't understand, but they could experience and see what was happening, and so they could give advice to people about on that basis.
So what was the original piece of advice in this book?
So the original piece of advice was from Cato the Elder, and the advice was about what to do with water sitting on wheat fields. So in the winter, you might have a wheat field and you might have water sitting on it. And the advice was that if it was going to warm up and come to spring, you really needed to get that water off, otherwise it would damage the crop. And so this was a piece of advice about temperature and the effect that it had on wheat when there was flooding.
Are modern farmers aware of this as well?
They certainly are. So this, obviously this information has been, we've known this for thousands of years, that there's issues with temperature and with flooding. But what I guess we were really trying to understand was, well, why is that the case? What is it that's actually happening in wheat in a flooded situation, and how is it impacted by temperature?
And so what did you discover in the research?
So we discovered that that's actually a really small temperature range over which the way that wheat deals with being flooded changes. So if you go down to about just under 20 degrees, then you find that wheat, when it's flooded, doesn't really respond very much. And this is at the level of metabolites, so molecules that are sitting inside the wheat plant. It doesn't respond very much below 20 degrees. But when it gets to a certain point, it does start responding. And that response actually helps the plant cope with the flooded condition. But when you get too warm, so when you get over about 24 degrees, you find that the response no longer happens.
Yeah, so you're not working with a huge margin in between temperatures. Is that important in 2018?
I think it's very important. I think the recognition now that all of these phenomena where a small temperature change can have such a big impact on the way a plant actually copes with their environment, especially a stress environment, is going to be a factor when we start thinking about small increases in temperature. So often when we talk about climate change or increase in temperature and think, well, a couple of degrees, is that going to bother you? Is that going to bother me? We might think it doesn't. Some people say, oh, I like hot days, right? But when you think about environmental situations where you have these trigger points and the change, it can have a really substantive effect. Just a few degrees can make a big difference in wheat. So in this particular case, we would be saying if the temperature is rising a few degrees, there will be a whole pile of wheat varieties which won't cope very well with flooding under those conditions.
Farmers are getting ready to seed, or some have started on canola, but they're going to get the cereals into the ground pretty soon. So that will be grown, you know, throughout winter, but then into spring. Are springs getting warmer here?
It varies, but overall, springs are getting warmer. And indeed, actually, flooding events are becoming more frequent as well. Those changes in weather patterns not only affect temperature changes, but also mean that flooding events are now more common than they were in the past. And everyone is predicting and expecting that sort of unpredictable weather and those unpredictable flooding events will continue to increase as we move forward. So this doesn't mean that that this is the end of the game. It's really saying that we need to be, when we're breeding wheat and thinking about wheat that is better able to cope with flooded situations, then we need to be making sure we're doing those trials at elevated temperatures to make sure that we are selecting wheat and breeding wheat that's able to cope with flooding, not just at temperatures that are there now, but the temperatures that will be there in the future.
What's the advice for growers at the moment? Are we sticking to the Roman advice of draining the fields?
Well, often, you know, in the scale of wheat agriculture now, draining fields is not very straightforward, but it is a recognition that the advice, I guess, now is that for people to be aware that if there are higher temperatures, that's going to have a greater impact on the wheat crop than if the temperatures were lower. So you can hope for lower temperatures, or you can be proactively be involved in the breeding process to be thinking about, are we breeding, when we're breeding for wheats that are able to cope with flooding conditions, have we considered temperature in that? Are we doing those studies and testing those varieties on the basis of coping at higher temperatures? We know from the work we've done, we know some of the components that are important for that response, but they're not really components at the moment that you could sort of treat a wheat field with.
Professor Harvey Miller, he's from ARC Centre of Excellence in Plant Energy Biology at the University of Western Australia, talking to Kit Mockin. 5 to 1 here on the Country Hour on ABC WA, Belinda Varaschetti taking you through until the news at 1. This afternoon, talking to you about some of that money being handed out by the Prime Minister for different infrastructure projects here in Western Australia. A lot of them, the big items in the city, in the Perth area, but a few of them beyond the CBD, I guess. One of them in particular is the Wellington Dam, and talking about that project earlier here on the Country Hour. But there's a question mark when you say, well, the Wellington Dam's looks like it's all go ahead with this funding coming out and being announced today by the Prime Minister, but putting a question mark over some of the other projects too, like the Southern Forests project. So we heard from Terry Redman earlier about the future of the Southern Forest Irrigation Scheme. He's quite confident it's still going to go ahead. But this through on text, not everyone in the Southern Forests area is in support of the Southern Forests Irrigation Scheme. The scheme will pump water direct out of the Donnelly River while potentially affecting future water allocations and development for self-supply water use. Thank you for that, S. 3-1 on the Country Hour to the wool market now. And a bit of good news, the Eastern Market Indicator up 21 cents to close at 1,846 cents a kilo clean. The Western Market Indicator up 15 cents to close at 1,949 cents a kilo clean. Tony Alossi keeping an eye on things for you this afternoon. Tony, how did you read the market this week?
Yeah, hi Belinda. Yeah, well, sale 43 this week. Nationally, we had 42,621 bars, which of 8,100 were at Fremantle. We had, over the 2 days, 16% passed in, 10% withdrawn. Individual market indicators at the end of yesterday were 18 microns, 22.55, minus 21 for the week. 19's at 2,083, minus 8. 20 at 1,986, minus 1. The 21, the medium and broad, is 1,964, plus 20. And the 22, 1,945, plus 45. The crossbred market, the finer end was up to 150 dirha, the broader end up probably about 50 dirha. The pieces and valleys 40 to 50 dirha, and the land blocks and crutchings unchanged. Belinda, our principal buyers in Fremantle were Tech Wools, TNU and Morris. Generally, sort of around the mark all the time, those three buyers, which is good. So, yeah, so we had a pretty good week overall.
What's happening next week then, Tony?
Next week, sale 44, nationally just 43,315, and Fremantle's got 8,200. And following that, weeks 45, about 38,500, and week 46, 35,000.
And do you expect what sort of the trend we saw this week to continue into next?
Yeah, I think so. Look, I think the market's going to probably hover around these levels. You know, it'll bounce up and down a little bit. Obviously, they're a bit nervous in China at these levels. But, yeah, it'll bounce around a little bit. But, yeah, well, I don't think it'll do anything stupid. So, yeah, pretty good.
Good to catch up. Thank you for that, Tony. Tony Alossi with the details of the wool market for you this week. ABC WA, it's a minute and a half to the news at 1 o'clock.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Rachel Mealy. On the program today, North Korea's Kim Jong-un and South Korea's President Moon hold an historic summit. But will the North be willing to give up its nuclear weapons? And the simple device helping to save the lives of newborn babies in PNG.
These village health volunteers in Papua New Guinea's Eastern Highlands are using a poem in Tok Pisin to spruik the benefits of a new device for babies. They're talking about baby cold kilocks, or baby cold clocks, a small temperature-sensing device that looks like a watch and straps onto a newborn's wrist.
More than the headlines, The World Today.
And it's not far away with about 30 seconds to go to the news at 1 o'clock. If you've got some time this afternoon or over the weekend and you just want to flick through some great stories, make your way to the WA Country Hour Facebook page. I've just seen one put up from Michelle Stanley saying that some good news for sweet potatoes. This is despite the region being in serious drought, the Gascoigne's Saxon Boston is bringing the old Wurrumal horticulture block back to life with sweet potatoes. Read all about it on the Facebook page. Talk to you on Monday, news time, 1 o'clock.